Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have a couple of matters we need to take care of before we get into our public hearings. We have two work sessions that are scheduled right now. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session for Senate Bill 945. The purpose of opening this work session is to let everyone know that we do not have the paperwork that's necessary to move the bill. Because of that, we will be carrying over Senate Bill 945 until tomorrow. It's quite possible that we may not have the material back from revenue and or fiscal tomorrow, which would mean we'd carry it over till Wednesday. But at this point, that bill, Senate Bill 945, is carried over till tomorrow. Close that work session. I'm now going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 963. And, Council, why don't you just tell us what we need to do here, or do you want me to do that?
Mr. Chair, I think it would be better if you do it. I'm not the staff person.
All right. Senate Bill 963 was referred to the Senate Committee on Judiciary. It turns out that the bill should have been referred to Senate Commerce and Protection, or Consumer and Protection and Business Affairs Committee. And the good chair is here to my left, and so the intent of this work session is just basically make the motion to move this bill out of our committee and have it referred to the good senator's committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate Bill 963 be referred for re-referral to the Senate Consumer Protection and Public Affairs Committee so it can join its the companion bill that's over there in that committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Bonamici moves that we re-refer Senate Bill 963 to the Senate President's Office for re-referral to the Senate Consumer Protection and Public Affairs Committee. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And now what we're going to do is go ahead and start our first of public hearings. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 809. And Council can give us an overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 809 requires the Attorney General to adopt standardized charging practices for use by district attorneys in charging persons with crimes in Oregon. You also have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you. Mr. Villegas is here to testify on behalf of the original bill. He's the person that asked us to file it.
All right. So what I think I'm going to do is have Mr. Villegas come up, and should we go ahead and put up the whole panel at this point?
Go with Mr. Villegas first, and then we'll go to the Dash 1 amendments, Mr. Chair, then I can explain some of the material.
All right. Mr. Villegas, if you'll be so kind to come forward. And when you're ready to get started, what I need you to please do is put your name on the record before you give your testimony.
My name is Ken Villegas.
Good morning, Mr. Villegas. Please continue when you're ready.
I've had a long-standing interest in the total, what I call conglomerate, because I think the administration of justice has not met the test of being a system. So I will use the term conglomerate. I've spent many years, I'm a native of Oregonian. I was born and raised in Eastern Oregon, have a real identity with Eastern Oregon, and rural and urban issues that emerge from that background. I'm an emeritus professor of corrections at the University of Oregon. I've been involved with the corrections process and the broader areas of criminal justice in Lane County and in the state of Oregon. Beginning in 1958. I've served on two of the task forces of the governors of the state, one as an associate member during the period that we developed the Community Corrections Act, and take some pride in that action at that time as being quite advanced, I think. I've been involved with advisory committees in community corrections, many of them, parole and probation advisory groups, juvenile court advisory groups, lately, well, sheriff's office with their jail programs. Lately, I've been involved with PSCC, and I'm presently a member of a subcommittee of PSCC. I take great pride in being a part of those groups. I've appreciated the work that, much of the good work that's done. Certain things, however, stand out One is that we seem not to have a coherent way of making judgments about human behaviors. It seems to me that it would be critical to have the behavior of individuals treated in the same fashion across boundaries, at least across a state. I find it difficult to understand how we can have a different response to behaviors in one county than the other. I'm not certain how many differences there are. I don't have good data about that. One of the things that you run into in this field, as most of you know, is whenever you raise the question about how things are going or what seems to work or not work, we always have a response that we don't have the data. I've been suspicious of that for many years and have commented about that. I'm suspicious that there's really a desire not to have the data. I'm also suspicious that a lot of our policies are driven by beliefs and not by data. So my message always is that we need to be more thoughtful about what we're doing. Now we have a crisis in our society. We have limited resources. The Lane County District Attorney has told me repeatedly that they do not have adequate resources and sometimes that they can't process certain kinds of cases. Now we have a long-term, probably, problem with funding. So now we need to really think about how we're using those resources and whether or not the things we're doing now meet some tests. I think the tests are fairly simple. If we are to have a coherent system and if it's to be just and fairly applied, it seems to me that we need to know if those actions that we take are indeed having an impact on public safety and whether or not they are effective. I hear a great deal of discussion now about let's use this period to just cut back on what we're now doing. I don't hear, and that assumes that what we're now doing has some real effectiveness. I don't find the evidence to suggest that the outcomes are effective. I hear a lot of beliefs about the fact that everything we're doing or have been doing, or much of what we've been doing, really is the basis for public safety, that we are becoming safer because of those actions. I would like to see some evidence that, in fact, that's the case. It appears to me that one thing we could do is to ask that Oregon have a way of operating throughout the counties, and I think that also relates to funding. I think also, besides asking the question of effectiveness, which I think is lacking, I think we also need to ask the question about what some of these downstream effects of the charging practices have on budgeting. How much does it cost if we could demonstrate effectiveness? How much does it cost downstream for the judgments that are made at the level of charging? I find it difficult to find evidence about what those costs are after we begin the process. Certainly we have to agree that the downstream effect of charging has a great deal of impact on all of the rest of the system. My message is that whether we are in hard times or good times, we need to be much more serious about looking at our practices. What are the practices doing with respect to the outcome? What are our goals? I must say that I find the use of public safety vague and sometimes misleading. It appears to me that we are saying that anything we're doing in this field, the purpose is to improve public safety, but we say it is public safety. It contributes to public safety. We must have these resources or else we will not have public safety. I don't find the connections. So the reason I have talked about this in the past, the reason I have raised the questions again, is I know we're talking about a territory here that it appears to me often keeps many things secret that really don't need to be secret. So I do want to make a plea to all segments of this conglomerate that we become much more visible to the public, that we have a statement that we can make to them that they understand. I must say, in my experience, that the public is very cynical and skeptical, and part of it, I think, is based on unnecessary secrecy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Vegas? Thank you very much for coming forward and bringing this testimony.
Thank you.
I'm now going to bring the another panel up. It's going to be Matthew Rubenstein, Jeff Ellis, and Bill Long. And, Counsel, did you want to make some opening remarks?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in your material you have the Dash 1 amendments, which would take this bill and make it applicable to aggravated murder with the death penalty issue. This is an issue that came up during the work group meetings that we've had over the last couple of months. You have in your packet some material. One is the cost of death penalty in Maryland. This is probably the most recent and the most thorough study done on the death penalty, and it's very long, as you can see in your material, but I think you can get a pretty good idea of what it says when you look at the abstract, which is right before the index. And then when you go to page 2 of the material, it has key findings in it. And then over to page and then page 3 also. And then over to page 5 and 6, what I think it also was done is done a great job of summarizing all the other studies that have come before. This was done by the Urban Institute at the request of the state of Maryland. You also have material of a study done in Washington by the Washington State Bar Association, and I believe one of our panel members participated in that. You also have a copy of Oregon's death penalty statute, an article from the New York Times concerning February 25th, what other states are doing. We're not alone at looking at this issue because of revenue shortfalls. And then finally, you have a letter that just came in this morning, an email letter from Judge Paul Lipscomb, who is retired. He was a former presiding judge of Marion County Court and Circuit Court judge. His extensive experience in, from the judicial viewpoint, of handling death penalty cases. We also have in the audience, if you need any further information as it relates to costs in Oregon, Catherine Aylward of the State Public Defender's Office, if you have questions in that area. She has not signed up, but I believe is available for questions. Early last week, I had a discussion with Mary Williams of the Department of Justice concerning the appellate and post-conviction relief area. We currently have, I think, 35 people on death row. The cost to the state of Oregon of litigating these cases for the biennium is approximately $2.8 million. They have a 10 to 20 year backlog in the post-conviction relief area, in the sense that it may take that long to resolve many of these cases. Some of them have been around for 20 years. I talked to Ingrid Swenson the other day, and just for these very same cases, it costs the public defender's office $4 million for the cases that have already been found in the trial court to be subject to the death penalty, and these people are now in death row, continuously litigating them. Some of these cases are going now to habeas corpus in the federal system. And one of the comments I found interesting, the state federal public defender's office, in the first case that has reached that stage, has put 6 attorneys on the case. So that means our Department of Justice will probably have to respond in kind with the same kind of person power. Chair, members of the committee, that's the information that's before you, and background information.
All right, first one.
Mr. Chair, a question for Bill. Is the current death penalty established in statute, Mr. Taylor, or is it in the, is it a provision of this state constitution?
Chairman of the committee, it's by statute. It's in front of you. It's not by constitution.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what drives a lot of the costs here is that the, under the federal constitution, the Supreme Court has, U.S. Supreme Court has set very high standards for these cases. As opposed to the normal case, there are at least two defense attorneys representing the accused. There are at least two experts relating to mitigation. There's extensive psychological analyses of the defendant, and there's two distinct parts of the phase. One is the innocence of guilt, and the other one is the punishment phase. And the U.S. Supreme Court has a habit of going through these cases with a fine-tooth comb, and oftentimes they're overturned on appeal or on post-conviction relief. That's probably the main reason for driving the costs here.
And it, would it also be a fair statement that based on how the Supreme Court views something today as compared to how maybe something was actually handled through the process when it was actually going through the courts can be subject to being overturned?
Chairman of the committee, I guess one of the big questions facing us in our post-conviction relief is that many of these cases were tried 20 years ago. There was a different standard then as regards to adequacy of counsel, and that's usually the biggest area where cases are overturned. The U.S. Supreme Court has applied a lot more stringent standard than they did then. That's the standard that all cases will be reviewed. So cases that were tried a long time ago may be suspect, which means we're back to square one.
All right. Senator Bowman,
I just wanted clarification on, you mentioned the public defender's office and a $4 million cost, but I wasn't clear on what that $4 million was applied to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Bonamici, I believe, and Catherine Aylworth is here, and she could probably answer better than I do. I believe that's basically post-conviction relief.
Thank you.
And post-conviction relief centers around inadequacy of counsel as far as for the defense. It also centers around issues. Was evidence withheld that would have shown mitigation?
And this is with regard to the 35 people who are currently on death row?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And Chairman of the committee. Our first panel will be going over a comparison of the numbers between Oregon and Washington, which will, I think, highlight some of the issues that have come up.
And speaking of which, the segue into our testimony, if you give us your name first and then the testimony, whoever wants to start off would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matthew Rubenstein. I'm the director of the Oregon Capital Resource Center. It's an institution designed to assist defense teams provide high-quality representation in death penalty cases. I'm funded by the Public Defense Services Commission. I currently represent an individual in a death penalty case. Last year, I entered as associate counsel two of the three death penalty cases that were tried in our state, led jury selection, and gave closing argument in the penalty phase. I represent two men on death row as guardian ad litem, and I assist defense teams across Oregon and across the country in preparing and trying death penalty cases. It's my privilege to present information this morning to try to give an overview of our capital scheme in Oregon. I believe being handed to you now is a PowerPoint presentation that I prepared, and then some color slides that show statistics of our death penalty and how it's used here in Oregon. I believe from a non-ideological perspective, the evidence suggests it's very costly, it's wasteful, and it's irrational in many respects. I'd like to discuss public policy, economic, and legal policy issues that flow from this, and then describe how I believe Senate Bill 809 could substantially improve the scheme. Just as a very brief overview, under Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, for a death penalty scheme to meet constitutional requirements, we have to have an eligibility phase and then a selection phase. Roughly 20,000 homicides in the United States in any given year. And the idea is the death penalty should be targeted on the worst of the worst. So there should be a process where objective criteria identify of all the killers, what types of murders are the ones that we are going to say make you eligible for the imposition of the death penalty. And then within that subset, there's a process in the scheme where you would identify and select the individuals who will be sentenced to death. The Oregon scheme is very, very broad. There are 33 different ways to elevate a murder case to aggravated murder. And in our state, aggravated murder carries the potential of a death sentence. It also, another option would be life without the possibility of parole, and life without the possibility of parole for 30 years. Professor Cantor, who is the dean of the law school, Lewis and Clark, his scholarship has identified the Oregon's capital scheme as broader than any other than the scheme in any other state. If we look at the number of aggravated murder indictments filed, it is significant. In the last 5 years, we've had 126 aggravated murder cases filed. When the aggravated murder indictment is filed, the death penalty is a potential sentence in that case, and it triggers a requirement on the defense function to appoint two attorneys who are capitally qualified, a mitigation specialist who is a specialist in identifying social history, biopsychosocial history information, and developing a defense to try to resolve the case, to persuade a prosecutor not to seek death, or at trial to persuade jurors not to impose a death sentence. When we compare the scheme in Oregon and Washington, the contrasts are quite stark. Our population is just a little more than half of the population of Washington. We have 51 cases pending at this time. Washington has 5. Our homicide rate is slightly lower than the homicide rate in Washington. Is used approximately 20 times more frequently than Washington State. Our death row has 34 men. The 35 men actually reside on death row. One of those men, Mr. Guzik, is pending trial. He has been sentenced to death 3 times. The Oregon Supreme Court has reversed his sentence 3 times. He is now proceeding on his 4th trial. The original trial happened in 1988. Is there a friend on the coast, prosecutor? Mr. Josh Marquis is prosecuting that case. The scheme in Oregon follows the Texas scheme. We're the only jurisdiction to follow the directed questions, the statute implemented in Texas. It's a 4-question scheme. The first question is, was it deliberate? The state has to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, if they can. The second question is there a probability the defendant would commit criminal acts of violence, so-called future dangerousness? That, again, must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. As Professor Cantor has written, 90% of this game is half mental, quoting Yogi Berra, which is the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there's a probability this person will commit criminal acts of violence. At times, intellectually challenging to understand how that concept is applied by jurors. The third question, and this is at a penalty phase when jurors are asked to decide what sentence should to impose, whether to impose life or death. The third question would be, was it unreasonable in response to the provocation? In most instances, if there was sufficient provocation, it would be a manslaughter case. We wouldn't be in a penalty phase. And the final and fourth question, Mr. Chair, is whether the defendant should receive a death sentence. This is a question that opens up the issue to consider aggravation, victim impact evidence, mitigation evidence, and then answer this question. Mitigation, under the United States Supreme Court precedent, is extremely broad. It doesn't have to tie to the offense itself. It can. Someone could have cognitive deficits that might affect their moral blameworthiness. It could also be that someone has served their country. It could be that someone was a good father, was kind to their mother. It is anything that would support a life sentence for any one individual juror. That's why the depth of our mitigation investigation must be so deep and so broad. Aggravated murder cases are extremely complex and costly in all jurisdictions. The ABA guidelines in 2003 identify the minimum standards that counsel must conduct themselves in to supply, to perform their jobs appropriately. And that, as I described, is two attorneys, mitigation specialist, and investigator. Also, compared to non-death penalty cases, we need to retain mental health experts. We need to retain forensic experts. We need experts that address this future dangerousness question, which is substantially more costly than a non-death penalty case. The Supreme Court has identified these ADA guidelines as establishing the standard by which counsel will be measured. And this is the Wiggins case from 2003 and the Rompilla case in 2005. The Office of Public Defense Services, which is the agency that implements the indigent defense across the state for the Public Defense Services Commission. John Potter is a member of the Public Defense Services Commission. He is present. They adopted these guidelines in 2007. The cost figures that we've obtained from the Office of Public Defense Services is that for a five-year period between 2004 and 2008, there were 110 cases that went to final disposition, of which all the costs have been determined. And the cost for the defense costs only, not prosecution, law enforcement, judicial costs, were $213,000 per case. So that 110 cases in that five-year period would be a total of $23.4 million just to defend these cases in this five-year period. By contrast, if a case is not aggravated murder, if it's a straight murder case where the death penalty is not an option, the average defense costs were $24,000, roughly 10%. So what is Oregon getting for this $23 million that we spent in defense costs over a five-year period? This chart shows in the blue cases that went to penalty phase, where jurors were asked to decide life or death. The red bars show death sentences. So, for example, in the last several years, we've had one or two death sentences per year. Last year, in 2008, we had three death penalty trials, and jurors returned life verdicts in all three cases. In that five-year period, we've had 22 cases that went to penalty phase. 15 of those cases, jurors returned life, 7 death sentences. So it's $23.4 million for 22 cases that went to penalty phase and a number of cases that were resolved. This chart shows death sentences over time. Our statute came into effect in 1984, and death sentences have been dropping. Over the last 5 years, they've been between 0, 1, and 2 sentences. This is consistent with national trends. This is an aggregate of all states, dropping from a high of 326 in 95 down to about 111 last year. Since our modern modern death penalty era, we've had 73 sentences of death. 53 men have been sentenced to death. There's a chart here, page 3 of 6, in the color chart, shows all of the men have been sentenced to death. The reason why we have more death sentences than individuals is a number of those sentences have been reversed, and men have been resentenced to death and reversed. There was a substantial number of cases reversed in 1989-90 following the Penry decision from the United States Supreme Court. Sorry, this is the slide that shows the number of cases. As an aggregate, about approximately 49% of our death sentences in Oregon have been reversed by the courts. We've not gotten into substantial federal court litigation. In district court, 2 cases have now proceeded in, or beginning to proceed in federal district court. We've not been to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit is a good forum for the defense community in capital litigation. We've had 3 people die on death row. 2 of those men volunteered, gave up their appeals, and were executed. 1 individual died of natural causes. We have had no executions of men who have pursued their appeals. Death sentences, the execution rates nationally have also dropped from 98 people about 10 years ago to about 50 people 2 years ago in 2006. The numbers have been lower in 2007 and 2008, but there's been litigation about lethal injection that affects those numbers. So the consensus, Mr. Chair, is from my perspective of talking with members of the criminal justice system in Oregon, is that there's an understanding nobody gets executed in Oregon. It's a system that people don't expect will ever actually carry out executions, or if it does, will be years from now. So why do we have 51 death penalty cases when Washington has five? This is a quote from Chief Prosecutor in Multnomah County, Mr. Frank. The threat of death, he says, leads defendants to enter plea deals. And I believe the consensus in the prosecution community, of course you'll hear from them, so I don't mean to speak for them, but the idea is that by charging death penalty cases, individuals have an incentive to plead, and it saves money. We have fewer trials. I believe if you look at the empirical data from other states, we don't need the death penalty for the state to secure life sentences and for people to plead guilty. States without the death penalty, Massachusetts, for example, has a very high proportion of their inmates serving life without parole sentences. Three of the top five jurisdictions that have men serving life without parole are jurisdictions that do not have the death penalty. New Jersey abolished the death penalty in 2007. There's anecdotal evidence from prosecutors there. It has not made a difference in their ability to secure guilty pleas. In New York, when they had the death penalty, they had first-degree murder and second-degree murder. They had a higher plea rate in second-degree murder cases in which the death penalty was not an option. Of course, if they needed the death penalty to secure guilty pleas, we would have expected the opposite. Of course, the costs when the death penalty is sought, the costs in the defense function increase dramatically. And committee counsel, Mr. Taylor, has shared with the committee some data in that regard. I don't want to belabor the point, but all of the studies, I shouldn't say all, many of the studies that are respected have indicated costs increase substantially. 48% in Tennessee, in Indiana, increased costs by 38%. They've done comparison of capital versus non-capital costs and assessments. The ABA has looked kindly upon these studies. The state of Kansas has added 70% to the cost of a murder case. California, it adds between $1.27 and $1.1 million for a death penalty case. Washington identified between $200,000 and $246,000 in a case. And Mr. Ellis, who's a law professor in Washington State, can address that topic more specifically. If Senate Bill 809 was effective in reducing the number of pending, the number of homicide cases that are charged as aggravated murder cases, it would reduce costs substantially. I suggest, Mr. Chair, that if the committee considered having an authorization committee, so with the Attorney General's office, for example, three or five individuals, perhaps they'd have members from different prosecuting offices sit on that committee for a time. But follow a practice that is used on the federal level. The federal level, local prosecutors and defense counsel go to Washington and meet with an authorization committee and discuss whether this particular case should be charged as a death penalty case or not. It provides consistency and proportionality. If that were to take place here, and we had 25 cases opposed to 110 cases filed in the next 5 years, the cost savings would be enormous. Instead of 100, so my analysis was with 25 cases over a five-year period, it would be $5.3 million just in defense costs. The 85 other cases that were not charged as death would proceed as normal murder cases. If the cost of those cases went up, say, even 50%, so instead of $24,000, they cost $37,000 per case on the defense side, that would net out to be $3.2 million. If you aggregate that together, it's $8.5 million as opposed to, I think the number was $21 million, which would be $15 million. I heard from Ms. Elwood this morning that if we did not have a death penalty, and I know abolition is not an issue for this committee or politically at this time, but the state would save approximately $17.5 million per biennium. It's my belief that we could have a death penalty, have a more rational system, more like our sister state in Washington, continue to put resources prosecuting and defending the worst of the worst type cases, and save substantial money. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Gentlemen, I'm not sure how much testimony you're going to be giving. I have another panel that I'm going to need to get on, and I have another bill after that. So I want to ask you to not repeat what we've already heard, and if you could give us your testimony in that light, that'd be wonderful.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Ellis. I am an attorney, and I practice in Seattle, Washington. I'm also a professor of law. I teach capital punishment now at Seattle University Law School. I've previously taught capital punishment at the University of Texas Law School, where I practiced for a period of time. And finally, I want to say this is a bit of a homecoming for me. I received my law degree at the University of Oregon Law School and worked at the Attorney General's office for 2 years in their appellate division while I was in law school. So I appreciate this opportunity to appear before you. My goal today is to try to perhaps give some explanations as to the differences between the Washington and Oregon systems, and certainly answer any questions that the chair may have or members of the committee may have about how the Washington system operates. Clearly, there is a difference, as Mr. Rubenstein's first chart demonstrates. Oregon has 51 pending capital cases. Washington has 5, which is frankly a relative high watermark for us recently. Over the last several years, it's averaged about 2 or 3 cases. I think there are some things that are clearly don't differentiate between Washington and Oregon. First of all, the homicide rates are not all that remarkably different. In fact, Washington comes out on the short end of the stick there. We have more raw homicides, more homicides per population. Certainly, I think the scope of Oregon's death penalty law is slightly broader in terms of crimes, murders that would be eligible, but it's not remarkably broader, and I don't think that tells us why there's a difference. Finally, I don't see a great deal of difference in the attitudes of jurors about the death penalty. I think our states are very similar in terms of their population, and certainly the results from cases that are presented to jury where they're asked to answer the death penalty question are not all that different. So here's what I see as some of the differences. First of all, Washington has a notice provision at the beginning of the case. By statute, a prosecutor has to make a decision in the first 30 days of a case as to whether that case is going to be a death penalty case or a non-death penalty case. Now, that 30 days can be extended by agreement of the parties, and it often is extended. But what happens in that initial period is there's a great deal of work done by both sides to determine really whether this case is the worst of the worst, a case that where there is a likelihood that a jury would return a death sentence, and just as importantly, whether there's a likelihood whether that death sentence would be then affirmed through the various portions of review that follow the imposition of the death penalty case. That notice provision, because it is reviewable both by the public in terms of a prosecutor needing to explain at the beginning of the case, and also judicially reviewable in terms of an appellate court looking at it afterwards, really has created, I think, a more generalized sort of statewide standard as to what cases are truly the worst of the worst, deserving of the death penalty and likely to be affirmed later down the line. The other factor that exists in Washington that doesn't exist in Oregon is a requirement of what's called proportionality review. It's a review by the state Supreme Court that really is a comparison of one death penalty case to other potential death penalty cases, not just cases that result in the imposition of death, but where death was a possibility, but perhaps either did or did not be, get imposed. And what that does, again, is create some sort of statewide consistency from county to county where it is relatively well defined of the eligible groups of aggravated murders, which cases are those cases where the money should be spent to seek death and which cases are not. And what we tend to see what happening in Washington is the vast majority of cases that are death eligible, the prosecutor doesn't seek death at the beginning of the case. And what that means for the remainder of the case is that the costs that are attendant with a death penalty case fall away at a very early stage in the case. Another difference in Washington versus Oregon is in Washington, the county bears the entire cost of the death penalty prosecution. So that's not only the county prosecutor, but it's also the cost of the defense attorney and all of the defense services. And I think what that does is it forces individual counties to decide early on whether this is a death penalty case based on real costs. In other words, the cost can't be transferred and borne by some other actor. In fact, what we see in Washington is not a system where prosecutors don't seek death sentences and then cannot achieve plea bargains, but frankly, the trend in Washington is exactly the opposite. Prosecutors oftentimes will charge not aggravated murder, but rather just first-degree premeditated murder, perhaps with other attendant felonies, so that none of the death penalty protections, if you will, kick in. And prosecutors in Washington have not complained about the failure to achieve plea bargaining or the failure to have devices that can cause them to settle their cases. In fact, we find that prosecutors will not plea bargain over the death penalty and still achieve plea bargains and obtain convictions at similar rates. Washington, I understand that Oregon is beginning to see the post-conviction costs that are attendant with death penalty cases. Washington's a little bit further down the line that way. We've seen that and have added that too. So we do not see differences in guilty pleas. What we see instead is because there are decisions that are made early in the case, and those decisions are informed by sort of a statewide standard, if you will, that at the very earliest juncture, prosecutors are making decisions about whether a case is going to be a death penalty case or not, and saving a tremendous amount of money, obviously, in those cases where it is unlikely that a jury would impose a death penalty, where it's unlikely that the case would ever follow through all the way to execution. So I'm certainly happy to answer any questions that the chair or the committee may have, and I appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Long.
Yes, thank you. My name is William Long. At present, in the past 10 years, I've been an attorney in private practice and a law professor at Willamette. My reason for involvement in this issue is my 2001 book entitled A Tortured History, The Story of Capital Punishment in Oregon. I can be very brief after what the two gentlemen have said. I just want to make three brief points. The first issue is why the cost issue has exploded. The second, very briefly, is why it's going to get worse. And the third issue is that part of the problem is expansive charging practices. Those are my three points. The issue first came to mind, or at least when I wrote the book in 2001, the conclusion that I reached is stated in the preface, and it says, "The central premise of this work is that the toll exacted on Oregonians in the last 17 years, since 1984, by the modern death penalty has far exceeded any benefits that its most zealous supporters can claim it has provided. This has occurred not because the death penalty is inherently immoral or because it has been applied in a racially discriminatory way, but because of the huge cost of unforeseen and unexpected consequences after the 1984 law was passed." When I made that argument in 2001, my liberal friends said, no, Bill, the issue is moral issue, and the prosecutor friends that I had said just ignored my argument, as if cost is not an issue at all. So I guess my first point is that 8 years ago, I saw what I think is now the issue before you, is that the costs were out of control, and it just wasn't seen at that time. And the reason is because of our statute and how it's applied. It's going to get worse. And there are three reasons why it's going to get worse, and that is because we didn't know then, and we still don't know, the implications of PCR. PCR is post-conviction relief, and how long that's going to take and how much the costs are going to be. When the bill was passed or discussed in the 83 legislative session, there was the general conclusion that it was not going to cost anything because PCR was really quick. We've had the PCR statute since 59, but death penalty was abolished in 64, so therefore we really never saw it get to work. Finally, when we did in the 80s and 90s, it was a very brief process, but then it started to gain steam, and we don't know how much it's going to cost. Part of the reason is all 35 cases have to go through one county, which is somewhat ridiculous when you consider the fact that each one of these aggravated murder cases emerges in the county where the crime happened. But all of these are funneled now through Marion County because that's where the gentlemen live, at the other end of State Street. Right. It's going to get worse because I believe the state attorney general's office is realizing that many of these cases, once they're in post-conviction, actually may get reversed. And that is not only going to send them back for sentencing, but for a whole new trial, 15 years after the first trial had taken place. I don't know if you'll get what kind of testimony you'll get on that fact, but I believe that's going to be increasingly the trend as we see that the standard now that we hold lawyers to is much higher than we did in 1985, 86, 87. We know more, and we expect more from our attorneys on the defense function. So those cases are going to increasingly have pressure either to resolve or to reverse, both of which have already accrued lots of money. And finally, the federal costs are just starting to come in, and Mr. Taylor said correctly, those are costs that you don't control at all because the federal government is funding the defense services up in Portland, but the state is funding the prosecution services. And so if the feds throw six attorneys against the state, they're going to have to respond, and we just didn't know those costs, and we're still just starting to scrape those costs. So things are going to get much worse unless you do something. And I think one of the issues is the extensive and expansive charging practices at the front end. As Matt said, we have 33 ways a person can be accused of aggravated murder, and even many of those are subject to litigation. I've been involved in cases where I've had to write massive 50-state memos showing that the charge that was made was really not intended by the legislature here in Oregon, but I had to do a 50-state comparison to show that was the case. The whole purpose of modern death penalty jurisprudence is to narrow. The whole purpose of charging practices, as I understand them now, is to broaden the net as widely as possible. I think that should be an issue before the committee, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Just a quick one, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question may be for Professor Ellis. I'm looking at the Oregon statute that was provided for us. What I'm trying to understand is if life without parole really means life without parole. And it looks like, according to the Oregon statute, it does. Do you have a comparable statute in Oregon so that the public would be convinced that if someone is sentenced to life without parole, that that really means that they won't be getting out?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bonamici, Washington does have true life without parole as the only other option for an aggravated murder case. Juries are told during the penalty phase that those are the two options and that life without parole means life without parole.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Our next panel is going to include Josh Marquis, Bob Herman, and Steve Dole. Josh, are you going to start?
I will start. Thank you. My name is Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Joshua Marquis. I'm the elected district attorney from Clatsop County, Oregon. I've practiced law in Oregon for about 28 years. I have in the unique position of having both prosecuted as a trial lawyer death penalty cases and defended as lead counsel death penalty cases, actually for 2 years in Lane County when I was a defense attorney in 1988 and 89. I've been asked to speak before the United States Senate twice on this subject, before the U.S. House of Representatives once, before the European Parliament, and I debate frequently the death penalty around the United States, and I've written extensively on it. But I'm not here to talk about my academic knowledge or lack thereof. My academic credentials can't compare to the professors that were just up here. I want to, however, talk about what we're really talking about today. We're talking about the functional or attempted functional abolition of the death penalty. The death penalty has been, in Oregon, has been popularly voted on and out four times alone in the 20th century. Oregon is, as many of you know, relatively unique in our referendum system. The people get to decide the laws they want. In 1964, I remember putting this bumper sticker on my dad's car that said, abolish the death penalty, and abolished it by, I think, 65%. And then 10, 15 years later, even greater percentages of Oregonians support it. Polling in Oregon now shows, depending on how you ask the question, between 65 and 80% of Oregonians believe the death penalty should be appropriate in some cases. It is for the worst of the worst. And I speak as someone who deals with these cases, and I have to tell you that I think we need to be intellectually honest in this argument. There are legitimate moral arguments against the death penalty. My own parents, for example, cringe every time they saw me listed in the New York Times as talking about the death penalty because they oppose it at the core of their being, in their case for moral, not religious reasons. There's many legitimate reasons to be against the death penalty, but frankly, one of the least compelling is the idea of cost. This is really catch-22. Oregon provides probably the highest level of indigent defense for capital defense in the United States. And I say that again, having both prosecuted and defended those cases. The irony is that the cost that the previous witnesses have told you about comes almost and exclusively from the fact that we really do offer a high level of due process for people charged with capital murder. Almost invariably, they're indigent cases, meaning the people of the state of Oregon pay for their prosecution and defense. But let's also be very clear about where those costs lie. The vast majority, probably 90% of those costs, lie in the defense. And I can speak from experience. When I prosecute, when I defended cases, my job, as one of the other witnesses talked about, was to gather mitigation evidence, because a death penalty case is not a case that is undertaken by any Oregon prosecutor lightly. We are not expansive. In fact, in the United States, there have been approximately 600,000 murders since the death penalty was reinstated by the Supreme Court's decision in Gregg versus Georgia in 1976. Approximately 8,000 people were placed on death row, and approximately 1,000 people have been executed. In other words, in the United States, about one out of every 1,000 murderers, the death penalty is imposed on them. Now, the fact of the matter is that means it's extremely rare. It's extremely rare in Oregon as well. I don't think you can just grab Washington off the map and say, let's look at Washington. But Washington, and I would beg to differ that it's only a minor difference. We have a 15% lower murder rate in Oregon. I don't think that's insignificant. 15%, particularly for the 15% of those people and their families that are not murdered, that's a very, very significant number. But really at the heart of this bill is an attempt to essentially get around the checks and balances that were built into our Constitution by its founders, which is to simply say, well, district attorneys are elected on a local basis, but we are state officers. We rely on the counties to provide us our funding, but the drafters of the Oregon Constitution knew what they were doing. They wanted district attorneys to reflect their communities. One of the comments made by the previous panel was that you have different counties and you have different results. That's absolutely correct. I don't believe we have anybody on your committee from Douglas County, but Douglas County, for example, is far more likely to impose the death penalty than, say, well, like even Lane County, which Senator Brzezinski served as a prosecutor in that county, in the DA's office and other places. You know, what one has to look at the people on Oregon's death row, not in the abstract, but in the specific. I believe, Senator Whitsitt, you represent the Redmond and Terrebonne area.
No, south of that, but I grew up there.
You grew up there. Well, the Randy Guzik case is not academic for me. The last 17 years of my life have been pretty much consumed by that. Mr. Guzik planned and executed the murder of Rod and Lois Hauser by going to their home in the summer of 1987 and murdering both of them, bragging about it later. Mr. Guzik has an IQ probably of over 140. He's a brilliant young man. He was very, very popular. He's completely against, not mentally retarded, not disadvantaged. And in fact, during the course of the trials, and I say trials because I've tried two of them, and I'm prepared to go back because I made a commitment to that family that we would try this case as many times as necessary. And if we did not have the death penalty, we would be trying far more cases. Let me just briefly talk about very specifics. In Deschutes County, for example, just about the only death sentence that has been handed down in the last 20 years is Guza. And the reason is because prosecutors, and between the years of 1990 and 1994, that was me, decided not to seek the death penalty. And not because of a cost basis. I would hate that we would get to a point in this state where we start deciding that the most important cases are going to be decided on how much money we can save. Because I can see just as easily getting to a point where we look at the average age of an aggravated murder, which is probably going to be in the 20s, and say, okay, well, if they're going to be in prison for 60 years, and the base cost is $25,000 a year, and then the geriatric cost, as I understand it now, goes as much as $80,000 or $90,000, what happens when we get to the point where we can prove it's actually cheaper to execute people? Would we ever want to be a state that does that? I don't think so. The fact of the matter is the people on Oregon's death row are there because they are the worst of the worst. The two most recent cases that I recall from Lane County are Conan Hale, who murdered three teenagers, and Jesse Compton, who tortured and murdered a little girl. In fact, I would challenge the previous panel, I realize they're not here to defend themselves, to name anyone, one person on Oregon's death row who doesn't belong there. Oregon is not, Oklahoma, for example, has a very similar population to Oregon, much closer than Washington's. They have 94 people on death row. The point is that each state decides whether or not they want the death penalty. Each county elects a district attorney. 12 jurors make these decisions, and they're made for very specific reasons. I was just, in preparing my testimony today, was just looking at the number of cases in which I chose not to seek the death penalty. And one of the reasons was the existence of the death penalty caused those defense attorneys to come to me before I could even make an offer and say, okay, would you be willing to accept a plea in one case before true life existed? And in each case, I said yes, and there was no trial. And there was no hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, and the families are not like the Hauser family, and have not had to spend 20 years waiting. The only reason that this takes so long is because we have such a level of due process. And I think it's, frankly, somewhat disingenuous to say, well, we can cut down on that cost. There's only two ways we can cut down on that cost. We can abolish the death penalty, in which I would submit you're, in fact, going to achieve no cost savings, because just think about this in the most basic terms. If the death penalty is off the table, if the worst that a client is looking at is life without parole, why not go to trial? What do you have to lose? The other possibility is life with the possibility after 30 years. And if you think for a moment that case trials that go on without the death penalty are less expensive, think again. I've tried at least two of them just in the last 10 years. Andrew Metz, who broke into a hotel room in 1991 at Seaside and slaughtered an elderly couple. The jury originally found that he was not eligible for the death penalty. His decision was overturned, the death penalty as it is in about 70% of cases in Oregon, none of them, by the way, having to do with the innocence of the defendant or prosecutorial misconduct, as might have been implied. Patrick Harned, who in 1999 sexually molested and murdered 8-year-old Ashley Carlson and buried her body in a basement in Astoria. Now, he wasn't eligible for the death penalty because he was 16 years old at the time he committed the crime. But we went to trial on that. We went to trial and we spent, or the public spent, hundreds of thousands of dollars on that.
Just a point of reference, we got about 10 minutes before.
Okay, I want to. Mr. Hermans has a lot more to add. One of the statements made by Professor Long, whose book I think was published by the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, a fine organization, but I don't think we could say it was exactly necessarily all that neutral, has said that I may be mixing up witnesses, and if I do, I apologize. That there really isn't research. There are. Cass Sunstein, who was just appointed by President Obama as the regulatory czar of the United States, is a progressive law professor at the University of Chicago, or was until his appointment. He You wrote an article a few years ago that called, "Is Capital Punishment Morally Required?" And someone who is ambivalent about the death penalty, but his point was that the research done in the last 10 years shows an absolutely clear correlation between the existence of capital punishment in those states and a specific decline in murders. And his argument was, whatever one may think about the death penalty, if research shows conclusively that it saves lives, then how can we not have it as an option? And I'll wrap up because, as the chair has pointed out, we have a limited amount of time. Prosecutors in Oregon take this enormously seriously. Each case has to be looked at in the context of who is the defendant, who is the victim, what is the defendant's background. Enormous amounts of time are spent on this. This is not a decision made easily. And finally, I'd leave you with, if you look at the state of Washington, two cases which would probably still be going on if Washington didn't have the death penalty, and that would be Gary Ridgway, who admitted to killing confessed to killing 71 women and was convicted of 48, and Robert Yates, who killed 10 women in Spokane, but for the existence of the death penalty. And Washington, by the way, does not have charging decisions. What this advocates essentially is taking the power away from the people who are elected by the people in their county and are accountable, and putting us back to a point where we were in 1973, when there were rigid charging decisions and the United States Supreme Court held that that was unfair and overturned the death penalty until a new sentencing scheme could come up with. And Oregon came up with one that has now passed constitutional muster. Thank you. We'll be happy to answer questions. And I'll turn it over to, I think, Mr. Dole is going to speak next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. However, today I'm not here representing Crime Victims United. Their position has always been one of neutrality on the death penalty. I am here as a citizen of the state of Oregon. I was born and raised here, raised in North Portland. I am not a bloodthirsty victim. I come by my beliefs through a lot of soul-searching and a lot of prayer. I also was raised in the Catholic Church, and I had to search through that and deal with that as I came to my conclusions about the death penalty. Two quick observations, and I'd like to make 5 points. I heard the criminal justice system referred to earlier as a conglomerate. I think that's offensive. The criminal justice system is for public safety, and it has very dedicated people working in it, from law enforcement to prosecutors, to prosecutors, crime victims advocates, to corrections officers, to parole and probation people, and treatment providers. It's not a conglomerate. It's not some kind of a multinational company. It's a public safety system. Second, I heard in previous testimony that Washington had a slightly lower murder rate than the state of Oregon. Actually, that murder rate is 15% lower in Oregon, and I could give you a number of reasons why it is, but I know we're not here for that discussion today. 5 points. One, what we should really be talking about today is honoring the will of the Oregon voters. And when I say that, the Oregon voters voted overwhelmingly in 1984 to reinstate the death penalty. And if we're talking about costs, the costs, as Mr. Marquis indicated, are involved in the appellate process. Two things we could do. One, put a timetable on the Supreme Court to ensure that the process works quicker, and two, dual track the PCR press, the PCR process along with the appellate process to again facilitate quickening the process. I know that the federal law, they put into place that they have to finish the death penalty appeals within a 12-year period. And this was passed a number of years ago in the Congress. Two, I want to talk about for just a minute the Scott Harbert's case. Scott Harbert's was a man who raped and murdered a 2-year-old little girl in Clackamas County back in 1994. I think it demonstrates this issue of how we move through the system. It took the Supreme Court 6 years to decide the fact, based on speedy trial rights of this individual, that he should be released from death row. Not for the fact that he was guilty. In fact, they never spoke to that. And there, in everybody's mind, there's no doubt about the guilt of this man. The fact that his speedy trial rights were abridged, and so we had a guilty man walking. Just a comment on the Guzik case. These are not movies. This is not Showtime. This is not Hollywood. This is reality. And the reality is that we have people on death row who are not crying that they're not guilty. These are all based on technicalities. In the Guzik case, one of the reasons why the case was retried is because, gee, the victims had the temerity to stand up in court and talk about the loss of their parents and what that loss meant to them and how that loss affected their lives. And so the case was thrown out and had to be retried, not because Mr. Guzik was innocent. Third, Mr. Marquis referred to this, but believe me, the costs of trials are going to go up, because you would be crazy as a defendant not to go to trial if you're facing a life without the possibility of parole in prison. Number four, the ACLU, both locally and nationally, has said time after time after time, once they get rid of the death penalty, their next target is, in fact, life without the possibility of parole, because they think everyone is redeemable. And fifth and last, the appellate process and appeals are not going to go away. If you think that just because somebody gets a life sentence or a life with the possibility of parole after 30 years or even a 25-year Measure 11 sentence for straight murder, as it were, these people appeal their convictions. So with that, I appreciate your time very much, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to take any questions, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Herman.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee.
Mr. Herman, before you get started, let me do this. Colleagues, I know that it's coming on the 10 o'clock hour. I'm going to stay and take some more testimony, but if you need to leave before we go to the floor, I think we're on the floor at 10:15. Feel free to leave when you need to. Mr. Herman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Herman. I'm the district attorney from Washington County. And by way of a little background, I was a deputy district attorney for 7 years, starting in 1975, chief deputy for 16 years, and then the elected district attorney since 1999. In the course of my prosecutorial career, I've tried over 24 murder or aggravated murder cases to a judge or jury, been involved in at least a couple dozen more, and certainly as elected district attorney, I've been involved in every homicide case in our county, which have been many, in regards to discussions of plea bargaining, trial strategy, and the issue that's before us today. I'd like to just very briefly focus on the bill itself, which, as I viewed it or read it, is not a bill that calls for the abolition of the death penalty, nor a bill that suggests that we decrease the number of cases that qualify under the aggravated murder statute. And I guess I would say that it's a different discussion, or at least a different bill. So I'm going to focus in on the suggestion that the Attorney General create guidelines. And I would submit that the guidelines for seeking the death penalty in Oregon are, let me back off and say I don't like that word either, seeking the death penalty. The guidelines for an individual being eligible for the death penalty have been established by the legislature. If a defendant commits a certain act that becomes aggravated murder, then the defendant is eligible for a potential death sentence, which could be imposed after a sentencing hearing by 12 citizens in the county in which he commits the act, after they've made a certain number of findings. And I think that's significant. I often tell the media when they say, well, you're going to seek the death penalty, I'd say, well, the issue is whether the defendant is guilty of aggravated murder, and then based upon the evidence that's presented to a jury, then they'll determine whether a death sentence is one of the three options that they think is most appropriate by unanimous vote. In my county, and I've heard the statistics and some of the arguments from other places, and I can really only deal with the realities of what I see day to day in our county with as fairly representative, I think, of one of the larger counties in the state of the volume of homicides we see, although nowhere approaching the number in Multnomah County. The practical consideration is I don't know what guideline the Attorney General could actually draw up to say that you can't present the death penalty case to Oregon under our present sentencing scheme, but if there were one, that would virtually guarantee more trials, in my view. And let me just give you a couple of specific cases. a lady by the name of Alla Bogdanoff, 26-year-old single woman, was a worker at a massage school in Portland. She met a fellow student there. They met to practice their trade. They're working. Met over at her home in Bull Mountain area, Tigard, Washington County, Oregon. He came armed with supplies to attack her. He tied her up. He split her head open. He stuffed a sock in her mouth. He slit her throat. He sexually assaulted her. He then defaced her body by burning her and trying to burn the house down. He then fled the area and was ultimately arrested in Reno, Nevada. Under a number of theories and a number of Oregon laws set by the legislature, he was charged with a number of counts of aggravated murder. Through the course of the investigation by his defense lawyers, they came to us with a proposal that Mr. Buxton would plead guilty to aggravated murder and accept the sentence of life without parole if we did not proceed to trial. And as you can expect to know, there was a lot of thought, consideration, a lot of discussion with the family of the victim, and ultimately we agreed to accept that plea offer. In addition to the, to those factors, he agreed that he would not seek any appeals, he would not seek post-conviction relief or federal habeas corpus, and Mr. Buxton ended up pleading to life without parole. I can guarantee you from the state's perspective that had he rejected that offer, we would have had a trial because we would have, under the facts of his background and the facts of that case, we would have accepted nothing else but life without parole. So we would have had a trial. One other case, and I've got six or seven, but I won't run through them. One other case involved four defendants, and very briefly, it was a kidnapping out the Clackamas area. The defendant was put in, or the victim was put in a trunk. He was transported over to Washington County. It was kind of a drug crime related involvement. It wasn't a stranger to stranger case. He was taken to Washington County where he was tortured in a home there in the Lenox area, shot in the head. His body was then taken up to the state of Washington, burned and dumped and burned along the side of the road. There were four defendants involved in that case. Ultimately, those cases all, again, were resolved through negotiation. They all were eligible for aggravated murder, or were charged with aggravated murder. Sean Coble pled to life without parole. He was the shooter. The person that assisted him pled to life with a minimum of 38 years before parole. And two of the lesser participants, but still eligible for the same penalties, pled to 10-year sentences of manslaughter. Again, the principals agreed to no appeals in that process. Once again, certainly with the principals, those cases would have gone to trial and there was dramatic savings. And I guess the axiom, I have other cases in our county, five or six, that I was able to come up with relatively quickly where we resolved cases without trial and many without appeal. And it's our posture when our evidence is sufficient and strong that we don't accept anything but life without parole or a lengthy sentence beyond that. But I can tell you from the lawyers amongst you know this, and you don't have to be a lawyer to know this, but with the basic philosophy of advocacy has been mentioned by both the speakers before me, I can't imagine any defense attorney or any defendant that's going to say, well, maybe in a rare case, but it's going to say, look, if the maximum I can get is life without parole, why in the world would I ever plead guilty? Why would I not put the state to the test? If that's the worst that can happen, there's going to be a trial. And unless the state backs down and says, okay, now we're in a posture where if we've got to go to trial, now we've got to give you the chance to get out someday, which is a decision each local prosecutor has to make. But it wouldn't be a very popular one, and at least in my county with my victims and my victims' families and my public, we're going to have trials if this is eliminated. And so as it relates to this bill, as I said, I can't envision how those guidelines can be created and be consistent with the present sentencing scheme in the state of Oregon. I think you have to go there first. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. That concludes the individuals that have signed up for on Senate Bill 809. Is there anyone else that was in the room that wanted to give testimony this morning? Not, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 809. And what I'm going to do, colleagues, I'm going to open up a public hearing for the sole purpose of taking testimony from Mr. Marquis on SJM 12. Josh, since you're scheduled to testify, I know you need to be back in your county. Why don't you go ahead and give us your comments on SJM 12.
And for the record, my name is Josh Marquis. I'm District Attorney of Clatsop County. In this incarnation, I'll refer, I am also on the Executive Committee of the National District Attorneys Association. For 10 years, I've represented Oregon on its Board of Directors. This bill is what's called a federal tax intercept. And what this would allow is for what we already do with state income taxes. And to be clear, this is not tax money. This is bad guys' money. Money that is owed to the state of Oregon either for restitution, fines, court-appointed attorney's fees. We have a real hard time in collecting this. Believe it or not, a lot of money could be collected. Right now, we do use the state revenue department to intercept those people who owe state income tax refunds. This bill would enable, and there's a company, federal legislation that Senator Wyden is co-sponsoring, would allow the federal government to, or actually get the federal government to intercept those monies. To give you an idea of the amount that would be recovered, we're talking about $60 million a biennium for the state of Oregon. There really is absolutely no downside to this, and this is money that at the moment has been, you're in ways and means, you're being faced with cutting out of the crime fines and assessments account. This is money that would go to victim assistance. I'm not sure if there's any, the only organized opposition to this or opposition I would imagine would be those people who actually owe the fines.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, SJM 12, at this time. I am going to carry SJM 12 over till tomorrow, so the Mr. O'Leary and Mr. Snyder, y'all are scheduled to testify. If you want to be back tomorrow to do so, please do so. With that, we're going to close our hearings for today, and thank you, everyone, for being here.